this morning, we were talking about is there any difference between sleeping and coming to the Zendo early in the morning and sitting? And Suzuki Roshi said, well, he didn't really answer that question directly, right? He just said, if you think that during Zazen, if you think that you're really practicing and your spouse is not, then that's not Zazen. I don't know if that answers it exactly, but then I also thought of, well, is there anything else that could be said? And I just recalled the story, one version of the story, of Dogen's awakening. I don't think he tells the story himself, but it became one of the traditional stories. We know that when he heard drop off body and mind dropped off. Yeah. But one version of the story is that he was sitting late at night in the Zendo. They sat all the time at Tendo Nyojo's place. And they didn't get much sleep, so people were nodding off regularly. And apparently the monk next to him was nodding, dozing, and Rujing Tendo Nyojo came around trying to wake everyone up and said something like, Zazen is dropping off body and mind. How can you just sleep? Shikan sleeping. And when Dogen heard that, body and mind dropped off for him. But there was this teaching implied that that maybe it's impossible to drop off body and mind while sleeping, which is kind of funny because you think, isn't that the perfect place? Isn't it kind of what's happening? Like body and mind have dropped off for you while you're asleep, and when you wake up, you pick them up again. So it's kind of an interesting, you know, little koan in there from Dogen's teacher. Kind of like you need to be awake to drop off body and mind. And I say to drop off body and mind because we could say that body and mind are dropping off while we're awake and asleep. But to practice dropping off body and mind, we have to be awake. To be in line with the reality of body and mind dropping off. Yeah, that's just another thought about sleeping. So we left off here. Nanyue said, I'm polishing this to make a mirror. This. We should be clear about the meaning of these words. There is definitely a principle in polishing a tile to make a mirror. There is the koan of realization. This is no mere empty contrivance. So again, there's the Genjo koan. One of Dogen's favorite phrases that he uses, but he doesn't use that much. I think he uses it when he feels like this is it. This is the heart of the matter. So he used it once already in this essay. But here, the principle of polishing a tile to make a mirror, that's Genjo Koan. That's the actualization of the fundamental point. A tile may be a tile and a mirror a mirror, but when we exert ourselves in investigating the principle of polishing, we shall find there are many examples of it. the old mirror and the bright mirror, these are mirrors made through polishing a tile. So this refers to other Zen stories. The old or ancient mirror, Kokyo, is a fascicle we're going to study this year, in which Dogen brings up all the mirror stories he can muster up, including this one again. Nanyuan Matsu story is in that fascicle too. Dogen turns it a little more. It's not quite as extensive here, but there's some great parts in there, but we'll wait till we get there. And that's the old or ancient mirror. The bright mirror probably refers to the conversation or the poems of the sixth ancestor. The mind is bright mirror. Where can any dust land? If we do not realize that these mirrors come from polishing a tile, then the Buddhas and ancestors have nothing to say. They do not open their mouths, and we do not perceive them exhaling. So, what's going on here? The mirrors do actually come from polishing tiles. Even though we think this whole story is about, you can't, how could you make a mirror by polishing the tile? Dogen, of course, turns it on its head and says, of course, all mirrors are made through polishing the tile. And I think this is the emphasis on practice, right? So that was in the original story. How can you, you know, do this kind of conventional practice of putting yourself in a sitting posture to make a Buddha? That's the metaphor, right? How can you make a tile, make a mirror by polishing a tile? How can you make a Buddha by sitting in Zazen? Well, it's not a matter of any particular practice. And yet, Dogen totally emphasizes particular practice. So here he's bringing up the point that the mirror comes from, we have to be careful with language. There's a mirror at the time of polishing a tile, or at the time of practicing Zazen in a particular posture, at a particular time and place, the mirror is manifest. Because practice and realization are not two for Dogen. It's only at the time of practicing Zazen or any wholehearted practice that the mirror is there. So the language kind of changes here, and you know, we'd have to look at different translations, but and Dogen himself goes back and forth about is it making the mirror through polishing the tile, or is it that the activity of polishing a tile, or we could say Zazen, is an expression of the mirror, and it kind of manifests the mirror. So the mirror is right there. As we've been talking about the mirror, right? It's not something that comes and goes. It's not something that's made. Zazen comes and goes. Sitting in a particular posture comes and goes. But that coming and going expression in any given moment is right there on the surface of the mirror. Right there, manifesting the mirror. That's my understanding of where Dogen's going with polishing a tile. We could say brings forth the full expression of the mirror. And there's part about if we don't realize that these mirrors come from polishing a tile, then the Buddhas and ancestors have nothing to say. They don't open their mouths, and we don't perceive them exhaling. We could say this is just about Dharma. Dharma being taught by Buddhas and ancestors. If there weren't any practice, then there'd be no reason to give practice instructions, which is what how the Buddhas and ancestors exhale and they say, just wholeheartedly sit upright. Their exhaled breath is Dharma instructions. But if the mirror is just spontaneously always present and there's no particular practice, then right, then the Buddha wouldn't have taught anything. And Dogen wouldn't have taught anything, you know? So if we say that, well, mirrors don't come from polishing a tile, then we kind of also have to say, well, then there's no point in all these Dharma teachings. Amatsu said, how can you produce a mirror by polishing a tile? Dogen says, indeed, though the one who's polishing the tile be an iron person who borrows no power from another, polishing a tile is not producing a mirror. Now, polishing a tile is not producing a mirror. And even if it is producing a mirror, it must be quick about it. That's a great line. So I think it's just back and forth between these different understandings of what we mean by polishing the tile to make a mirror, right? So I think now he's going back into the usual interpretation. He's always shifting, though, and keeping us on our toes, shifting back and forth between, well, this is the conventional way to read the story and a new way to read it. So this is implying the iron person is like, you know, the one who so diligent in practice, never wavers in their diligent effort, so they can, you know, polish and polish and polish, and they, because they won't let up in the polishing, that tile will eventually become a mirror. So Dogen's, indeed, though the one who's polishing the tile could be an iron person who borrows no power from another, just through their own self-power of their great effort, even an iron person practicing that way, polishing a tile is not producing a mirror. We could say, through this great effort of an iron person practitioner, that's not what we're talking about here. It's not about great heroic effort. In that case, polishing the tile is not producing a mirror. And, but, you could say, even if there was such a case where it does produce a mirror, even if it is producing a mirror, it must be quick about it. We could say, because in the previous understanding of Dogen, right, it's like polishing any wholehearted engagement with the present, whether you're an iron person or not. Right, just a beginner's mind sitting zazen, letting go of thought, is itself bringing forth the mirror. So that's the version where polishing a tile is making a mirror, you could say. So now he's going back and saying, well, what about this great, effortful, strong, heroic, diligent effort of practicing over a long, long time? That's not what we mean by polishing a tile to make a mirror. But, of course, even that kind of person can make a mirror, right? Even great heroic effort can make a mirror. So even if it is producing a mirror, it must be quick about it. I mean, it must be like immediate. Not just quick, but not the heroic effort over many, many years or lifetimes. But it must be the same principle as anybody wholeheartedly engaging. Quick means immediate, not just like, you know, effort for a little while. Just one moment of zazen, like we chant at noon, right? One moment of zazen is completely, you know, in accord with the entire universe. That kind of quick. So even this great diligent effort could still produce a mirror. If it does, it must be like the immediate type of producing a mirror. at the first moment of great effort, is already manifesting the mirror. Make sense? It's playing with these two types of what we mean by polishing a tile. The gradual, effortful approach is not quite it, and yet we don't exclude that either. And if we don't exclude that, then still the type of polishing that's actually producing the mirror must be immediate. That one moment of wholehearted practice, the mirror is right there. We could even say, polishing the tile is the mirror. It's not so much making the mirror, or that the mirror is polishing a tile. Dogen maybe doesn't say it that way, but how about that? The mirror is polishing a tile. Indeed, let's see, Nanyue replied, how can you make a Buddha by sitting in meditation? By Zazen. Dogen says, this is clearly understood. There is a principle that seated meditation does not await making a Buddha. There's nothing obscure about the essential message that making a Buddha is not connected with sitting meditation. So here he's just straightforwardly, he's taking a break from his kind of like radical overturning of every sentence. He's saying, well, this is just pretty clear, right? You're not, Zazen doesn't await making a Buddha. Nothing obscure about this essential message. Matsu says, then what is right? Or how, meaning like, how should I practice then? But he says it literally like, in Chinese, then what's right? What's the right way? And you can imagine what Dogen's going to do with this. These words resemble a simple question about this practical matter of what to do, but they are also asking about that final rightness. You should realize that the relationship between what and right here is like, for example, the occasion when one friend meets another. The fact that he's my friend means that I'm his friend. Similarly here, the meanings of what and right emerge simultaneously. In other words, it's not an interrogative question, right? It's a definitive statement. And remember, this is Matsu, in this version, Matsu has already intimately received the mind seal. So instead of like being all confused, well, now you told me like this, how should I practice, teacher? It's a little more like they have this dialogue where they play out this thing about the mirror, and then Matsu, to kind of like cap it off, says, ah, then what is right? Yeah? Then what is right? But a nice metaphor Dogen uses is like one friends dependently co-arise, right? This is a friend of this friend because this is a friend of this friend. They emerge simultaneously. That's the kind of relationship between what and right. What is right? Just like figuring and making a Buddha are like two friends. Now we move into some, as the Carl Bielefeld's note says, references to various bovines. carts and oxes. Now, anyway, replied, when a person is driving a cart, if the cart doesn't go, should he beat the cart or beat the ox? We could say strike. This may play in here, but or may not, but this word for beat or strike is ta, and it's the same ta in shikan taza, and it can mean literally like to strike something, but it's also like a verbal emphatic, kind of like an exclamation point. It can be used in that way grammatically. So shikan taza, shikan means just or only, and za means sit, right, sitting. So the ta is like, you know, just sit, just sitting, or sometimes we translate just wholeheartedly sit. The ta is kind of like the wholeheartedly. You can't quite really translate it, but it's nice that it's in there. And if I think if we just say just sitting, which we often do, we miss that kind of energetic quality of Dogen's Shikan Taza. That's not just like, well, just sitting around. It's like just. Yes.
Is the ta, do we translate ta sometimes as only just sitting? I've heard people say that.
I think only and just are almost synonymous.
Sure, but it's like kind of like a re-emphasis.
Emphasis. Oh, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe re-emphasis. Just only, really, we mean it, nothing else. Sit. Not like sit and think a little bit about what's happening next. Or try to stop thinking about what's happening next. Just only, completely sit. That's the calligraphy that's hanging in the Dokusan room above the seat. The big vertical scroll says Shikan Taza, done by my teacher in Japan, Tangen Harada Roshi, who would, when in Dokusan, there, some of you have heard the story, the Dokusan style at Bukokuji, where I practiced, was everybody goes, they ring a bell, and everybody goes together. And so in Sesshin, there may be 60 people or something. It happens several times a day, so it has to be quick. It must be quick about it. So you basically just present what practice you're working on, and you just kind of like observes the way you say what your practice is. Basically, is often what all the Dokusan consists of, how you say it and meet him like that, and then he just rings you out. So I was intending to practice Shikan Taza. So the form for Dokusan is you go and do the bows and you say Shikan Taza Nisanjit Orimasu, means my practice is Shikan Taza. And so he knows basically no English. So a little bit, a few phrases. So it would just be like a little bit like play, just a little dance. Say wholeheartedly say Shikan Taza Nisanji Dorimasu, and he'd say Shikantaza. Hi! Yo yo! Means like continue. Ding 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 ding. Next. Or sometimes, one Dokusan stands out, I remember, in the maybe Rohatsu, maybe February. Sesshin, in the depth of winter, very, very cold, you know, nothing's heated in the Japanese temples. So he's back there in the Dokusan room, and a little old man, 70s, 80s, kind of nose all red because it's so cold. Breath, clouds of steaming breath. Sitting down. Shikantazu ni sanji orimasu. Big cloud of like vapor. And then together, we'd say, shi. Big cloud of vapor. Vapor clouds. Zah! And we both just laughed and he rang the bell. Dokusan can be like that. Nanyue replied, when a person's driving a cart, if the cart doesn't go, should he ta the cart or ta the ox? Somebody asked me in Dokusan, well, where's the cart supposed to go anyway? That's a good question. Where are you trying to, you know, get the cart to go by striking whatever you're going to strike? Your life cart. So maybe, you know, conventionally speaking, I think I said something like, how about peace and freedom? We're on the road to freedom. But that's kind of like, could be a little goal-oriented, maybe too. We might get into some idea about that. But I think we do come to practice for aiming in the direction of peace and freedom. But we could also say just like, the cart's just like stagnating, it's kind of stuck and it's in the ruts that we built the cart for. Remember that story from a previous day? Must have been yesterday. It's like building a cart to fit the ruts. Maybe our cart is just stuck in the rut, and it's not so much like we're trying to go some particular place, but we just want to get things moving. We just want to get the chi flowing. Doesn't need to go any particular place, but let's take it on the road. Go for a ride in the country. We don't even have to burn petroleum products. The ox will take care of it. So remember this, here's one story that this may be, cart ox thing may be coming from. Karl Bielefeld says, this metaphor undoubtedly reflects the story, which I never heard before, from some kind of obscure sutra, in which a Buddhist nun comes upon a Brahmanical ascetic engaged in pancha tapas, the five fires, basically yogic practice, yogic ordeal of sitting in the sun surrounded by four fires. I like to try to practice that practice myself before we put this shade up here. This is the first ashim we've had this window shade. It's a little sad not practicing the sitting in the middle of five fires. Very hot. Yeah. This is just February too, right? Mm-hmm. Life in Santa Cruz. Anyway, the Buddhist nun criticizes this ascetic for broiling the wrong thing. You know, he's broiling his body and his eyes or whatever. And when the ascetic asks in anger, well, what should I broil then? The Bhikshuni replies, you should broil the mind of anger. It's like driving an ox cart. If the cart doesn't go, you should strike the ox, not the cart. The body's like the cart, the mind like the ox. in that case, in that story, he replied in anger. I think that was why. What do you mean, what should I broil then? Ah, I was just checking out if you'd mind me asking. Seems like maybe you do. So in that case, you should broil, you should burn up the mind of anger, or, you know, your greed, hate, and delusion. Not just broil your body here to get to practice, you know. Probably it is, it's mind related, these kinds of practices, right? To work on patience and so on. But you should go directly to the source. Buddha said this a lot in the early sutras because there were many people in India doing all kinds of cart striking practices. He was, you know, he was kind of into some of them. Yeah, that's true. But some, there's one particular sutra in the middle length discourses called the Dog Duty Ascetic. You can read. And he basically, he's talking to all these yogi ascetics in India who have all these different austerity practices. One of them is dog duty, which means, like, basically you I guess people did this, this is in the sutras, you basically act like a dog. I think you have the vow to always walk on all fours, eat your food off the ground with your mouth instead of your hands, and maybe be naked or something. Why? Yes?
Interestingly, that sutra also includes an aesthetic that is an ox duty aesthetic. They hang around, well, like the dog duty aesthetic hangs around a dog, the ox duty so it hangs around with oxes and eats grass.
Kind of funny, like, I mean, think of how difficult these practices would be. Maybe it's just they kind of randomly chose what would really help me to let go of all my preferences. You know, the Buddha was like, the middle way was like, we'll just have one bowl, we'll eat everything out of one bowl, but not off the ground. That's going too far. But we'll mix it all together. Now our kind of like, our simplicity practice in the middle way is, we'll have three bowls and we will not mix them together. You can give up, you know, distinguishing the flavors and enjoying them separately, or you can give up mixing your tomato sauce and pasta, sometimes in Oreoki. So, you know, I think maybe the most noble reason to practice these ways would be like really developing patience. Like, I really don't mind basically anything that's happening here after this kind of practice. Like, other hardships are like not so bad. Maybe like that kind of developing patience. But the Buddha criticized the people. He had ascetic practices, but they were always designed to be like not harming the body, not just like being in pain for the sake of pain. I mean, sasheen, where you could see is maybe some kind of ascetic practice where often it gets painful, but it's not pain for the sake of pain. It's just a byproduct of our diligent effort to sit still for a long time. I personally feel like we should try to be as comfortable as possible in sasheen. It's hard enough. So make yourself comfortable while still sitting still and upright. So, in this sutra story, it sounds like the cart, you know, is particularly like some kind of practice to attain some goal in the future, right? Ascetic practices, but here you could even, it's being applied just to zazen practice. Any particular practice that's like a means to an end, and also particularly with the body, right? That's like if that sun sitter just understood that that there's no self there in the first place, then he wouldn't be having to like tame this self in the sun. So body cart, mind ox seems to be a classic understanding. Sometimes it's said like practice is the cart and realization or the kind of fruits of practice is the ox. But if we know that Dogen says practice and realization are not two. So it's kind of a problem to strike one as opposed to the other. So Dogen now says, now when we say the cart doesn't go, first he's going to talk about this issue of where it's going and what is this going anyway. When we say the cart doesn't go, what do we mean by the cart's going or not going? For example, is the cart going analogous to water flowing, or is it analogous to water not flowing? So this is in the Mountains and Water Sutra. Dogen talks about this a little bit, and we have a classic Zen story about the bridge flows and the water doesn't flow. It's kind of like this matter of perspective. Like the Genjo Koan, we say, when you ride in a boat and watch the shore, you might assume that the shore is moving. But when you keep your eyes closely on the boat, you see the boat moves. So it's like this matter of perspective. So when we're talking about the cart going, the cart seems to be going, but if we're in the cart, right, and it's a very smooth ride, like if you're in a very smooth train ride, you might not be able to tell if the train is moving or not. Very smooth cart ride. It may not seem to be going anywhere, and yet it's going, and vice versa. Each thing abiding in its dharma position seems to be just abiding in one position, and yet it's there's a flow to. There's winter and then there's spring. So this, if we're trying to have our cart go somewhere, this is one practice we could start to investigate is, well, what is this destination somewhere else that we're going anyway? Even if we say peace and freedom, I could say, well, is that, what is this future peace and freedom? Is it something that's not here right now? There is a sense in which we can say that the flowing is waters not going, and that waters going is not its flowing. Therefore, when we investigate the words, the cart doesn't go, we should approach them both in terms of not going and in terms of not going. For it's a question of time. The words, if the cart doesn't go, do not mean simply that it does not go. Should he strike the cart or strike the ox? Does this mean there is a striking of the cart as well as a striking of the ox? Are striking the cart and striking the ox the same or not? If it's body and mind, if it's practice and realization, can we really divide these, either one of those pairs? In the world, there is no method of striking the cart. But though ordinary people have no such method, we know that on the path of the Buddha, there is a method of striking the cart. And this is the very eye of Buddhist study. In the world, when if you're trying to get the cart to move, you have to deal with the ox. But in Buddha Dharma, we have this method of striking the cart, and it's the very eye of practice and study. In other words, when you find a quiet place to sit, free of drafts and vapors, arrange a cushion and a mat and put a cushion out on it, sit in a cross-legged kneeling or chair position, align your ears with your shoulders and your nose with your navel, rest the tip of your tongue against the front roof of your mouth with teeth and lips both shut. Your eyes should always remain slightly open and breathe gently through your nose. Once you've adjusted your posture, take a deep breath, inhale, exhale. Rock the body right and left. Settle into a steady, immovable sitting position. We have this cart striking practice. It's the very eye of Buddhist study. after you settle into a steady, immovable sitting position, think of what doesn't think. How do you do that? Non-thinking. You could say that's kind of like a little bit more like ox striking. But first, you strike the cart. Align your ears with your shoulders. Your nose with your navel. It's like Dogen's very, very keen on the physical body of zazen. Yeah. Cart striking. And very keen on, once you have your body adjusted and you settle into a steady, immovable sitting position in the phenomenal world, then think of what doesn't think. Strike the ox. You can strike them both at the very same time. And if we're talking about practice and realization, definitely we should strike them at the same time. And we should be quick about it. Even though we study that there is a method of striking the cart, we should give concentrated effort to understanding in detail that this is not the same as striking the ox. Uh-oh. And even though the method of striking the ox is common in the world, we should go on to study the striking of the ox on the path of the Buddha. So that may be just a very conventional thing. We're not talking about actually striking a bovine creature here. We're talking about mind. But it is an interesting point where he says we should study, give concentrated effort to understanding in detail that striking the cart and striking the ox are not the same. Even though we strike both, we don't just mush it all into one thing. We say, first, arrange your posture, sit like this, and then drop off body and mind. We could even say, this is the two truths. Yeah. Conventional truth is like you have a particular time, place, location, posture on the earth, like those two people sitting on the ground. That's za. And at the same time, there's body and mind is dropping off. You arrange your body like this, but even though body is dropping off, you polish the tile at the same time that the mirror is right there. Polishing the tile reveals the mirror that's already here. So they're not separate. I think we can say they're not the slight bit separate, but they're not the same. The two truths are not the slight bit separate. But we say there's a conventional truth and an ultimate truth. This is how we talk in the conventional truth. In the conventional truth, where we're talking, which Dogen happens to be doing, where we say there's two truths. It reminds me, though, of a story that at my Shuso ceremony, you know, we have these, the head student of a practice period at Tassajara, and like we do here, everybody in the practice period asks a question, and then the former Shusos ask questions, and it goes in order from the most kind of most recent former Shuso to the like most senior past Shuso. So it's a little scary at Tassajara because you have like the abbots and people like that, or the abbots, I guess, don't actually ask questions, but the right up to that, people who've been practicing with Suzuki Roshi get to ask you questions, and they get progressively more challenging as they go along. And I think we were studying maybe something, maybe the two truths were in there in the study, but somehow I was in that space of the ceremony. For those who've been to Shusoi, it's like we set up the space so you can just like drop into the present, and you actually maybe sometimes don't really even know what's happening, and you don't know what time it is and what you're doing there. You're just responding. And I was responding from and getting into this mind of this very sort of maybe ultimate kind of perspective of like, this really isn't what's going on here. It's really like the beyond what seems to be happening here. So I think I started answering more and more like from this more ultimate perspective. And then, actually, you know who it was? It's Mary Mosin. Doreen just practiced with Mary Mosin. It was Mary Mosin at this Jusso ceremony in 1994. No, 2000. It was 2000. And she said something like, well, this is like, you know, these your answers are so ultimate. I thought there were like, aren't there like two truths in Buddha Dharma? And I was like, you know, I looked at her and felt like from the core of my being, no. And I said to her, no, there actually aren't two truths. And she had like no response, because like, well, what, are you just going to contradict the whole Buddha Dharma? But I remember kind of feeling that, of like, knowing like, well, of course there's two truths, but like right now I'm just, no, there aren't two truths. Because, you know, from a certain perspective, there aren't two truths, right? And from a certain perspective, there are. Just while we're on the topic, this is a little off this two truths topic, but while we're on the topic of that particular Shuso ceremony, the other one that really moved, challenged and moved me was Paul Haller. He's a tough one at Shuso ceremonies. Now I think once he's been abbot, I think maybe he doesn't get to ask questions anymore. But this was before he was abbot, and maybe the last one in line even. And at some previous question in the ceremony, somebody said something like, you know, how do you meet the Buddhas and ancestors? Something like that. And you know, the Shuso is holding the staff, right? And in the moment, I just let go of the staff and I just dropped on the ground. And then I picked it up, and that was the end of that, and we went on to the next question. And at the beginning of the ceremony, for those who know Shuso, you hold up the staff and you say, this is the Dharma staff, and so on. The only mosquito biting an iron ox, I cannot give it away. So Paul kind of remembered these two aspects of the ceremony. When he got this question, he said, I thought you said that you wouldn't give that staff away, and you actually let it go. How could you do that? You promised you wouldn't give it away. He's very serious about this, and it really, like, I started getting really like, oh no. It's here now. He's like, you gave it away. And I'm like, well, but I have it now, right? I was searching for something, and I'm like, he kept coming back, pushing it. You know, you kind of like broke your vow. You gave up that staff. You said you would not give up. And then something turned in the pressure of the moment. Something turned, and I said, I didn't give it away. And he said something like, good boy, thank you very much. In a way, that does have to do with the two truths, right? Because I was really caught in the conventional thing that he was trying to like, you're so into the ultimate now, let's see if I can pull you into the conventional. And he was really doing it, yeah? Is this ox striking the water buffalo, or ox striking the iron bull or the clay ox? Is this striking with a whip with the entire world, the entire mind? Is this to strike by using the marrow? Should we strike with the fist? The fist should strike the fist, and the ox strike the ox. Not something striking some other thing, especially when we're talking about that white ox wandering around an empty ground. You could try to strike the ox with the cart and strike the cart with the ox, but maybe better just strike the cart with the cart and strike the ox with the ox and strike the ox cart, the cart ox, with the cart ox. Well, Matsu did not reply. And Dogen says, we should not miss the import of this. In it, there is throwing out a tile to take in a jade. There is turning the head and reversing the face. By no means should we do violence to his silence. In other words, it seems like in the original story that he was kind of speechless and, well, do you strike the ox or strike the cart? And Matsu say, but remember, he has intimately received the mind seal. So his silence is like the definitive expression. Do you strike the cart or strike the ox? It's like Vimalakirti's lion's roar. It's like everything's included in his silence. And throwing out a tile to take in a jade is, according to the footnote, a polite way to ask for a capping verse for your poem. In other words, which might happen in Zen koan study, but say you have a poem and a verse you want a kind of capping verse or someone to finish your poem. So it's a polite way of saying, I'll toss you my tile, my kind of rough poem. Please add a jade verse at the end. I respect you as a poet. Please cap off my poem with a jade-like, my tile-like poem with a jade-like verse. So there's throwing out a tile to take in a jade. In other words, Nanyue is throwing out this tile-like question. When a person's driving a cart, if it doesn't go, do you strike the cart or ox? Matsu adds in his jade-like response of silence to cap off that question. Yeah. This is Suzuki Roshi about this part of the story. This is in 1965 in San Francisco, when Matsu was practicing Zazen. Nanyue said, why do you practice? What's the purpose of your practice? So that's how he, what are you figuring to do sitting there? But why do you practice? He translates it. He said, I want to be a Buddha. And Nanyue, the teacher, picked up a tile and started to polish. Disciple Matsu asked the teacher, why do you polish a tile? Is it possible to make a tile a mirror? The teacher said, no, it's impossible. He's embellishing the story a little bit. This is a very famous story. To polish a tile, that's our practice. Even though you polish a tile, tile is tile. So you polish a tile, not so much to make a mirror, the mirror is already there, but you polish the tile as the tile. You just practice zazen as zazen. But the polish is our practice. Whether it doesn't matter whether it will make a mirror or not. To polish it is our practice, and that's the goal, that's the enlightenment. The effort to polish is based on our true nature. You could say, why? Why do you practice, right? As Tangen Roshi said to me, Buddha nature. Our true effort is the basis for this effort. I mean, our true nature is the basis for the effort to polish the tile that pulls us back into another day of sesshin. Inconceivably. Well, let's have a conversation with this Buddha nature and maybe we can work out some kind of deal with it, that it won't try to convince us to come another day. But it's not like we can make deals with it. It's just shining. Our true nature makes us polish the tile. So whether it will make a mirror or not is not the point. But Matsu could not understand it. So Nanyue said, if the cart does not go, if the cart driven by a horse, he says, does not go, to which do you give your whip? That was the question. Because Matsu thought the cart, the horse, is something, and its cart driven by a horse is something different, you know. Those are two. This is unedited here. Matsu thought that the cart and the horse are different. Those are two. Because he thought horse and cart are quite different. In other words, that practice and Buddha, or to attain enlightenment, is different. So he said, which do you give your whip? Which do you strike? Do you understand? If you practice hard, you will attain enlightenment sooner. If you're lazy in your practice, you will attain enlightenment later. This kind of understanding is usual understanding of practice. But actual practice is when you practice zazen, the practice itself, or enlightenment, not separated from enlightenment. The practice itself, not separated from enlightenment. Practice is not separated from enlightenment. When you practice it, the practice is the expression of your true nature. Where you practice it, you have your true nature. And so you have to accept that true nature, express on that moment. That's Nanyue's suggestion. It's kind of nice. Express on that moment, on this moment of our true nature. When you understand this way, you can apply whatever you do. It is expression of true nature. Scientific research, philosophical study, or artistic work. We could go on and on. This is your daily life practice. All our culture is expression of our true nature. But if you understand our practice as a means of attaining enlightenment, you cannot apply our practice before you attain enlightenment. And he laughs. But if you have right understanding of practice, whatever you do, that is expression of Buddha nature. To repeat, if you have right understanding of practice, whatever you do, that is expression of Buddha nature. There is big difference in your understanding between those two understandings of practice. The practice that's separate from realization and it's not separate. Yes.
So the idea of just chopping wood is not something you can do before you've practiced.
Right, you can't do it before because you can't avoid the practice while you're just chopping wood. You can't say, like, let me chop wood and then I'll practice, because chopping wood is so quick about it that practice is right there, like it can't be avoided. So it can't be like a before and after. And we could say the realization is there when we're just shikan chopping wood and carrying water. Yeah.
But can you do that without sitting?
Yeah, in fact, I think it's best to chop wood while you're standing. Without sitting in between choppings or sitting before, in between choppings or before, you know, to really chop wood, you have to sit a whole bunch first. And then maybe to really chop, you should have the chopping block set up right next to your cushion so that immediately upon getting up, you can, okay, like really just shikan taza here now. Quick, chop it before I lose it. I think, not necessary, and yet, conventionally speaking, in this world, doesn't it appear that the practice of sitting meditation does permeate into our daily activities?
That's what I'm...
Yeah, doesn't it? That's, I think, from a conventional perspective, it's like a very kind of practical way of looking at it. That's, I think... If pressed on the topic, some of you might say such a thing. That's why you come to practice Zazen, because it does help our chopping wood and carrying water practice. But since we're immersed in the middle of this acupuncture needle, the pivot around which the universe turns, Sashin, then we don't, you know, need to speak so practically. Dogen doesn't, you know, at least in this essay, Dogen doesn't seem to be too practical. Fukan Zuzengi, is kind of his place where he gets most practical, when he says about like lining up your ears with your shoulders and your nose with your navel. I think tomorrow morning we'll chant the Fukan Zazengi. He gives some practical postural suggestions and then says, think of what doesn't think, and drop off body and mind. So, practically speaking, I think we know that Zazen, we may have known at one point that Zazen seems to be beneficial for our life. On the second afternoon of Sashin, we may have forgotten what the practicality of this. Or I could see the practicality of maybe a period of Zazen a day, but this is going a little bit far. Is this really practical? Maybe that's part of Sashin, it pushes us out of our practical understanding of Zazen. I think that's true for myself, that like my Zazen, it's kind of like my Zazen that's built to fit the ruts of my daily routine. Like, yeah, I have Zazen like this. It helps to do these periods about this much time. Just right. And this is just like break the whole thing open and just like just sit till you drop. Wear out several Zafus. That Dogen says, I don't think I brought it. So I think he says in the looking at this, because in the 37 elements of enlightenment fascicle of Dogen, he goes through this traditional list, including, you know, the four foundations of mindfulness, the Eightfold Path, all these classic Buddhist lists Dogen comments on in his wacky way. And, he's going through the Eightfold Path, and he gets to right thinking, which is translated, thinking is the same as think of not thinking. It's the same thinking. So, as you might imagine, what is right thought? Is that how we translate? We chant that sutra. Do we say intent?
Right.
Right view. I think we say thought. Right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This is the middle way realized by the Tathagata. We chant that first teaching every week. What?
Setting in motion the wheel of Dharma.
Setting in motion the wheel of Dharma Sutra. And right thought or right thinking. Or you could say right intention. Might be a more, in some ways, I don't know which one's more accurate. It's a somewhat funny word.
Right view, right thought, right speech.
Right. Yeah. I think it's samkalpa, which is in Sanskrit and Pali, which I think is like, has to do with thinking, actually. There's another word for intention. Anyway, when Dogen is commenting, what is right thought? He, of course, says, to think of what doesn't think. and maybe he goes on a little bit, how do you think of what doesn't think? Non-thinking. He said, also we could say right thought is breaking a zafu. Yeah. Like wearing out your sitting cushion. That's what we call right thought. Right thinking. I think that's related to the story, yeah. So, if you have a kind of newish zafu, you maybe have to sit a little longer because it's got thick layer. If it's already been sat on a lot, you might be close to breaking through to the inner nature of Kapok. Kapok, which when it's you try to stuff it in a zafu, it just disperses into the air. If you try to gather every particle of Kapok, it's very difficult. And it's said that it's really not good to breathe Kapok fiber. It's like this dust. It's like asbestos, yeah, it gets into your lungs. So when stuffing zafu is at least like more than one, it's good to wear a mask. You don't want to like take in this like essential core in some like physical way into your body. It might give you cancer or something. Best to let it just drift off into like the space of the whole universe. Also, if you're having difficulty in zazen, if you forgot all these stories and what we're doing here, and you want just simple instruction in the midst of the struggle and strife of sesshin, space, like where all that kapok goes, spaciousness, I think is really helpful. Sesshin, you can start to feel everything start to like gets tight and kind of closed down, and maybe feel claustrophobic or like living in this room basically for 5 days, and like we need some space. So it's just, there is space all around. Our, it's another name for the mirror, is space, spaciousness. Spacious awareness is the mirror-like awareness. But if you're getting kind of sick of the mirror thing, just relax into this painful body and open to the spaciousness. It's another just image, it's a metaphor. We're not talking, it's not physical space, but it's mind space. The spacious quality of mind that's surrounding our little trying to work it out. mind and body. Spaciousness. May all beings enjoy polishing, and may the merit arising from our diligent efforts here be offered to all tile polishers. May they enjoy the mirror behind their efforts. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.